This is going to be an abbreviated intro today. You're listening to Woods and Water South Carolina on 94.5 WGTK, and I'm your host, Roger Metz. I was there along with my family and saw it from the front row. You can see it tomorrow on NBC at 3 o'clock as Anthony Gagliardi finished off an incredible season on the FLW Tour on possibly the biggest stage in bass fishing history with a win at the 2014 Forestwood Cup right down the road in Columbia, South Carolina. And Anthony is on the phone with you, and I want to welcome you to the Woods and Water, South Carolina.
Thank you, man. I'm glad to be here.
I really appreciate it. And we're going to try to get you into the game. How's that?
Sounds good. Let's do it.
Anthony's down there tailgating at Clemson today, his alma mater, and he was good enough to join us today. We'll get right to it, Anthony. Tell us about the rule and what happened on Lake Okeechobee.
Oh, man. I'd like to. I've told this story probably one or two more times than I'd rather. But, yeah, it was just an oversight on my part. We have a new rule in state for this year that says we can't be on a body of water, you know, the tournament that we're fishing. We can't be on that body of water with somebody that's not confirmed in that event.
Okay.
30 days leading up to our official practice period. It's not a no-information rule. We can still talk to people. You can still get help. You can still get GPS waypoints if you want to. You're just not allowed to have somebody in your boat.
Okay.
And I knew about the rule. I was aware of the new rule. And I was down fishing the Ray of that event on Okeechobee, which is where our first tour event was going to be.
Right.
And it was about a month before. And I thought that tournament fell outside that 30 days. And that's why we were allowed to fish it, because I knew that we were allowed to fish it. There were some other tour pros there for that event. But it turns out there's a stipulation in that rule, an exemption pretty much, that allows you to fish a tournament even if it falls in that window, as long as it's a sanctioned event and it's a pro-am format. And I wasn't aware of that portion of the rule, so the first day I was there, I practiced with a friend of mine from Santee Cooper. He was down there fishing the Rayback as a co-angler.
Okay.
And he fished with me one day, and then I fished by myself the next couple of days and never thought anything about it until about a week before I was scheduled to leave for the tour. Nobody knew that I was even with that guy. But somebody sent me a text and about another angler and who they practiced with. It just got me to thinking, you know, well, I wonder if that rule was in effect, you know, while we were there. So I looked it up, and sure enough, I realized it and made the call shortly thereafter to the tournament director and told him about what happened. And, you know, he pretty much had no choice except to DQ me. And that's how my year started off. You know,
wow.
I had my hopes this year. You know, all off season was just looking forward to it, and just, you know, took a devastating blow before the season even got off the ground.
We got off with a bang on this first question, but for those of you listening out there that don't keep up with the FLW Tour and know how these things work, it's a point system. Just like if you watch NASCAR, you know, every race you build points. The FedEx Golf Cup, you golf and you raise points, and those points determine your standing during the year. So when Anthony says, you know, I messed up a little bit, I called Bill Taylor and he disqualified me. You started off one of six events of the year with a big fat zero, right?
Exactly, yeah. So I was one full tournament, you know, behind the eight ball before the season even started, which, you know, under normal circumstances makes it just about nearly impossible.
Right.
You have to have a really special season. And it had only been done, you know, to my knowledge, only once prior, where a guy zeroed in the tournament. This was during the course of the year, not the first tournament.
Right.
He zeroed one and got 0 points and still qualified. So I knew it had been done by one other angler, but it was just, it was a tough pill to swallow, I can promise you.
Well, and not only was it, you know, the right thing to do, but we're talking a lot of money here because each one of these tournaments pays out about $100,000. The FLW Cup was $500,000. So, you know, we've got guys cheating down in Alabama for $1,500. By stowing fish in a fish box and going and getting it from under the dock, and you're turning yourself in for something that has nothing to do with the tournament you're even fishing in.
Right. Exactly.
Which is a lesson for all of us out there listening. You know, it may be tough and the consequences may be dire, but you never know the outcome when you do the right thing.
That's
all right.
Sure. Let's move on to a different topic. Sure.
Okay. Well, one that's kind of tied to it. All right. I know you said that just about made you quit the tour. What kept you fishing?
Well, you know, obviously I was in a situation where there were probably some knee-jerk reactions. You know, it was very emotional, and I don't think that there's probably any scenario out there that would have, you know, that I would have followed through and not fished. But, yeah, when that first happened, it for sure crossed my mind. You know, I was just so geared up and looking forward to having the chance to qualify for the Cup in my backyard. And that's what just made it so hard to accept, was that I just, in my mind, I felt like I had blown my opportunity to qualify for that championship on my home lake, where I felt like I had a really good chance to do well. You know, I had a chance to redeem myself a little bit from the last time we had that Cup there. And,
right.
And chances are, you know, we may never have that tournament there again the rest of my career. So I just kind of felt like, you know, I just blew my one and only last opportunity to do this tournament here on this lake. And it did. It crossed my mind. Like, you know, is the season even worth fishing the rest of them?
But, right.
You know, I thought about it, and I was, this is what I do for a living. And that was probably what, you know, once I realized and thought about, well, heck, what would I do if I quit? It didn't take me long to realize, okay, well, you know, my best option is just to keep, you know, just keep this thing going and just try to make the best out of the situation. And my wife helped a lot. You know, my wife definitely helped a lot, and, you know, tried to pull my spirits up and lift my spirits up from where they were. And so without her, yeah, the whole season wouldn't have been possible without her help, for sure.
Yeah, she wrote an article I read and said that she was, when you first mentioned that, she goes, I'm going to be in for a long, difficult year in summer if he doesn't fish the tour.
Yeah, she wouldn't know what to do with me.
All right, FLW Cup on Lake Murray, your home, really important for you to be there. But those bass on Murray in August, they're moving, chasing shad and herring. It's your home waters, but being your home waters, does that give you any more of an advantage over anybody else, or is that time of the year just a toss-up for any tournament?
It's a little bit of both. Every time we go somewhere in the middle of August like that, you know, some bets are off the table. You know, there's always going to be some things, some off-the-wall patterns, you know, off-the-wall parts of the lake. Typically, you know, local anglers don't think they're good. That always happens that time of year. But at the same time, I definitely had an advantage. You know, I had an advantage here because I was, you know, I was familiar with the lake. And I didn't necessarily have a whole lot of experience on the water in that time of year. I just don't fish much in August because everybody knows how hot it is.
Oh,
down there.
Boy, it was hot.
Which that probably helped me out in the long run because I didn't really fish off past history, which that's one of the problems that local anglers run into sometimes in a big tournament. They remember places that they've caught them for years and years, and you kind of get, you fish too much on history and not on the present. So I didn't have to worry about that. You know, everything that I fished in the tournament was something that I either found this year, or maybe even last summer. I fished a little bit last summer, but I definitely had an advantage out there in that deeper water, knowing where a lot of those places where those fish tend to school.
Right.
And I just felt like if I had enough of that stuff, you know, if I had enough of those schooling type places and then a couple other backup patterns, that I knew I had a chance. I didn't know if I was going to win or not, but I knew I'd have a chance if I could make it into the thing.
And that was the road, was making it into it.
Exactly. Yeah, a long road, but yeah, it ended at a pot of gold.
It did. I followed you around out on the water some Thursday and Friday. And for those of you who don't know what in bass fishing, you have a gallery, which is, you know, other guys with bass boats who kind of follow you around the lake while you're fishing. You know, Thursday, Friday, I didn't make it out there Saturday and Sunday because I was back here. The gallery seemed to be really nice, stayed off of you. Were they that good Saturday and Sunday?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were. I mean, they were fine all 4 days, no doubt. And I enjoy being out there and having people behind me that, you know, if I want to talk to somebody for a little bit, you know, I have somebody I can have a conversation with. It's just nice. It's just nice having people out there that are showing support.
Yeah.
It's no different than any other sport. You can ask any sports star, or not necessarily star, but anybody that plays sports, would they rather play in an empty arena or, you know, stadium, or would they rather play somewhere where there's people watching? And I think they'd all probably agree that it's just more fun when you know that you have support from other people. And I think it makes you focus more and try harder. And I think it's the same position.
That's great. I talked to you Friday after the weigh-in. And, you know, Thursday morning and Friday morning, you went to a specific area on the lake where you found some fish. Thursday morning, it was really good for you. Friday morning, pretty good to you, but you decided to leave a lot earlier. And you ran to the dam, and we followed you, and you weren't at the dam more than 15, 20 minutes and packed up and ran somewhere else. And you're joking Friday night that anybody wanted to follow you around Saturday and Sunday would need a full tank of gas.
And if anybody stayed with me all day, they probably burnt most of it. I held true to that statement. I did a lot of running. Like I said, that first morning on Thursday, things started, they couldn't start off any better. And I had no idea that it was going to be like that on my starting spot. I didn't realize it was that good and there was that many fish there. It was a special place. I mean, that kind of petered out after that first day, which I had a feeling it might. And I did a lot of fishing in a lot of different areas on that second afternoon, just looking for another section of the lake that I felt like I might concentrate on those later days, and it just never materialized. And that second day was really tough on me. I only caught three fish off that starting hole and just fished a lot of water that I felt like should have been productive, and it wasn't. And that's when I decided to make a move late in the day and ran way up the river and to fish in shallow brush and caught a 5.5-pounder, which really salvaged my day on day two. It gave me right at 10 pounds or a little bit over. Only with four fish, though. And that kind of keyed me in as to what I felt like I needed to do the next day. And so I actually caught two grilled key fish using that same pattern late that third day. Which, I mean, any one fish, I can't put one finger on a fish and say, you know, that's the one that won it for me, because any one fish, I needed all of them.
Right.
I was winning by now.
Speaking of not one fish that won it for you, did you think you'd lost a fish that might have won it for you Saturday or Sunday?
Yeah, I knew you guys bear with me. I got a conference flying over and headed to the stadium right now. But I knew I lost one on Saturday or on Sunday on that final day. It was early in the morning, and you never really necessarily get the feeling when you lose one that early. You don't really feel like, you know, I just lost the tournament. But I knew that it was a big one, and I knew that it would really have helped me.
Yeah.
But it helped me from a psychological standpoint. I caught my second biggest fish about two casts after I lost that one. So I didn't dwell on that one fish for a long period of time, which is good to kind of, you know, clear that out of your head. And that allowed me to keep fishing and not worry about it. But that fish was probably, you know, it would have given me a little bit of a cushion for sure. So if I lost any one fish during the tournament that I felt like I needed the most, it was definitely that one.
That final weigh-in Sunday was absolutely incredible. Like Steve Kennedy came up there 10th place. Now, there are only 10 guys fishing on Sunday. 10th place, weighed in 20 pounds, 2 ounces. I'm sure all the other guys on stage right along with you were like, uh-oh, somebody else going to have another bag like that one.
Yeah, I knew. I mean, I knew that he had a really big bag. You know, it doesn't take long for the rumor trail to start. You know, when a guy catches a big bag, we all had heard and thought it was actually bigger than that. We had heard in the low 20s easily, like 22 pounds at the minimum. And I didn't even care what everybody else had. When I already had 22 pounds, and I knew I didn't have enough to even come close to that. But, you know, at that point, I wasn't too worried about what anybody else had, because I knew I probably wasn't going to win. But when he did weigh in and it was only 20, then, you know, there was a little bit of, you know, the juices started flowing a little bit, because I thought, you know, maybe I do have enough to squeak by that. So that final weigh-in was definitely a lot of ups and downs. Now, I went into it, I walked up on that stage thinking there's no way I had a shot to win. You know, then he weighed in, and I thought I did. Canterbury weighed in and passed him, and it went right back the other direction, and I felt like I probably didn't have enough for him, and it was just back and forth like that all the way to the end. So definitely, you know, from my standpoint, it was the most dramatic weigh-in that I've ever been a part of. And, you know, from what I've heard from the people that watched it, they kind of agreed with that as well.
Look, my whole family was sitting there right in the front row, and my wife and oldest daughter are, you know, bass fishing. Okay. You know, my little one is all in it, but from the minute that weigh-in started, they were in it. I mean, actually my oldest daughter had tears in her eyes when you won. So,
really?
it was just amazing to watch people get sucked into that weigh-in. It was that incredible. Well, I'm sure I'm not the first person to ask you this, but what was it like at the moment you heard this? Hang on.
Well, here we go. Let's make this official. You need 12 pounds and 1 ounce to win your second Forestwood Cup. A limit of bass for Brent Ayler worth 11 pounds, 10 ounces. Your champion is Anthony Gagliardi. Wow.
What was that like?
It was special. If you can see me now, that still puts a huge smile on my face listening to that. You know, it was a whole year's worth of emotions, you know, negative emotions, positive emotions. It was just a whole year's worth of emotions that kind of came up to, you know, just that one point in time where it was either going to happen or it wasn't. You know, I've been building up to that, and it's hard to explain even still, you know, a month and a half out, it's still hard to put into words, but I've never wanted anything as much as I wanted that tournament. You know, Angler of the Year, all that stuff back then when I was in the running for that, even the year I won it, I didn't want that near as bad as I wanted this. Just solely due to the way the year started out and just everything that I, you know, had to endure to get there. And it was going to be really tough on me to have gotten that close, and if I'd finished second by just an altitude, it would have been really tough for me to handle that. And it was just a huge breath of relief. A lot of emotions flowing. My family running up on stage to greet me. I'll probably never top that moment, in the rest of my career. And, even saying that, I'm completely 100% fine with that, because there's not a lot of anglers, get to experience, that kind of thrill and that kind of satisfaction from winning, something on that stage on your hometown, in front of so many supporters, after a year like I had. So I'm really blessed to, have been able to just finish it off and do it. And like I say, I'll probably never top that the rest of my career. It was a really, really special moment for me.
It was absolutely incredible. That place just erupted. Not only was it everybody there knowing what kind of year you had, but the anticipation and then a one ounce win, 4 days of fishing, 45 other guys out there who all fish for a living just like you, and they all had the same chance, and it comes down to an ounce. Incredible.
I made it in the cup by an ounce. A lot of people still don't know that.
That was a Kentucky leg.
Yeah, I tied to the last spot into the cup. So if I'd have had one ounce less than what I had, I wouldn't have made the tournament. So it was nerve wracking, but I wouldn't want it to be any other way. I'd rather have won by 1 ounce than by 10 pounds.
Yeah.
Just because it just makes it that much more safe. So I just think it was a fitting end to the year, for sure.
It was a great one. Now, something fun. And I'm not going to ask you what you threw. Everybody can read that you threw swim baits and this sort of thing.
Right.
But if you could choose a month, and I'm assuming you'd pick Lake Murray, and I could be wrong in that, but a month, a lure to throw, and it was just you having fun. I mean, you obviously love bass fishing, but this would just be having fun fishing. Where would it be and what would you throw?
Okay, that's pretty easy. it would be Lake St. Clair.
Lake St. Clair.
Detroit River. Probably the month is hard, because being up there in June when those big smallmouth respond is outstanding.
And okay.
It'd be hard not to pick that. But I think that going up there in late summer, like in August, September, throwing a crankbait of all things, and like St. Clair for those big smallmouth would be my number one fun day of fishing. If I could just go do that, you catch so many fish out there.
Yeah.
Big smallmouth, and they hit that thing so hard, it's just unbelievable how hard they hit that crankbait. Just throwing it out there in that open water 2 miles off shore, any direction you want to cast. And just burn it back to the boat as fast as we can, and they will try to take the rod out of your hand every time they hit it.
And I've done a little bit of smallmouth fishing, so I understand exactly what you're talking about. They hit it like it owes you money.
Right, yeah. They don't just want to eat it. They want to hurt it.
Well, I don't know. If you give me just a second, I don't know how much press your wife, Kristen, gets, but I ran across an article that she wrote for the FLW about last season, and I just wanted to read it. For you, for the guy, people listening, it's just a fitting kind of end of your whole year, and it starts out, "We learned a lot this season." This is Kristen talking. "Anyone can make a mistake. Self-respect is the reward for admitting that mistake and dealing with the consequences as best you can. You should never give up. Striving to stay positive is the best way to recover from life's hard times. And foremost, always trust God and be thankful for the blessings he bestows, especially the ones hidden beneath the blanket of trials." And if you had a blanket of trials ever in your life, it was probably last year as far as professional bass fishing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, she summed it up as best she could, as far as career and things like that. That was definitely a blanket of trials for me, and everything she said is true, and it's something that I hope that I can really take to heart from this point going forward, and just, learn from this, learn from that whole experience, and just understand how important it is to remain positive and have faith, and that's how you endure situations like that. So hopefully, and I think I have, I think that I can, go forward from this point with that mindset and mentality. And I think that it should propel me to even greater things in this career.
Well, that's great. Well, look, I want to thank you for making the cup. That being down there was my first real media event. Wednesday when I pulled up to media day at the ramp, I was intimidated. I kid you not. I've dealt with the IRS for 26 years, and I didn't think I could be intimidated by anything, but I was intimidated. You guys were so nice. I mean, willing to talk to me and at the weigh-ins, at the launches. It was an event I'll never forget, probably never one I'll be as excited to be a part of. unless you repeat next year. Now, are you going to make me come to Hot Springs, Arkansas?
Well, that'd be nice, wouldn't it?
It sure would.
Now there's a new storyline for me, at least. I'll be in the discussion now. You know, will we have a second time winner? So
right.
I can get to be included in that. And it's a unique situation where I can look forward to that event already. You know, most of the time you can't do that. You don't want to start looking ahead to the championship because you got to make sure you qualify. But, you know, from having won that one, we have the automatic berth in the following year's championship. So
right.
I know I'm going to be there and have a shot at it. So that'd be pretty amazing for me to, you know, win during the circumstances that I did this year, and then the next year be the first one to claim a second victory in that thing.
Oh.
That's going to be the goal for this year.
Then I'll go ahead and put it on my calendar to be there.
Sounds good. I hope I see you there.
Well, thanks for being on the show. You got about 4 minutes to make it to the game time at 3:30.
Oh, that's fine. I can meander in there whenever.
Well, I'd like to touch base with you from time to time, keep up with what's going on, and maybe have you back on the show as the season starts.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to anytime you like.
Great. And Seattle was a good trip for you?
Absolutely. Yeah, I went up there, and I'm coming out with a line of rods. It'll probably be, you know, first part of next year, and you know, spend some time out there with the guys at Batson Enterprises. And I don't know. I don't have a name for Rock Company. It's all the listeners out there. Yeah, if you got a cool, catchy name, put it on my Facebook page, because I've been racking my brain trying to come up with something, and I've been struggling with that. So, yeah, I'd be interested to get some other people's ideas. But
well,
it'll be a lot of fun. I've never done anything like that before, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, as far as being creative, you are asking the wrong person. But I know there's other people out there who have – tons more than I do. Maybe somebody will hear it and come up with a name for your garage for you.
Yeah, great. I'll give them a free fish. Whoever picks the name, if I use it, I'll give them a free fishing rod, the very first one.
There you go. Anthony, great talking to you. Great story for the year. Like I said, probably one of the biggest weigh-in finals that FLW will ever see again. And, look, go have fun watching the game.
All right. Appreciate it. Good
yes,
time.
Sir. Wow. You know, a rule like that, you and I don't know, how much would we jeopardize? Well, he won $500,000 at the end of last year, or in August on Lake Murray. So at least $500,000. But I wonder, you know, I didn't ask him. I didn't even want to go there, but what would that win have been like for him if he hadn't come clean, so to speak? And I know I read all the stories. I mean, he called Bill Taylor, and Bill Taylor pretty much said, there's nothing I can do for you. You know, the rules are the rules, and you're disqualified. And it, 30 days before the season, I mean, it had nothing to do with the fish he was going to catch during that tournament. But he's really nice. Those, all the pros down there, and I met them all, you know, Casey Ashley, Matt Airy, the guys from North, Brian Thrift, met some guys from, you know, Steven Johnson from Texas, Brad Knight. Just a bunch of nice guys, to be bass fishermen. You know, how cool would that be to be bass fishing for the living? But it was a great time. The, I just got a press release from the FLW. The original scheduled time for it airing on NBC was tomorrow at 2:00. It's now been bumped to 3:00 tomorrow, and you can see it live. It's an hour show. It's going to be real condensed. If you're more interested in things, the FLW website has footage from day 1, 2, 3, and 4. In fact, the final show, I think, is an hour and a half long. I've watched it all. There are pictures out there. I've got a bunch of pictures up on the Facebook page. You need to watch it tomorrow because it's, I don't care. If you don't know anything about bass fishing, it just pulls you in, and the excitement. And I tell you, when Steve Kennedy hits that stage at 10th place, pulls out 20 pounds of bass, it really gets tense, and it just sucks you in. So I appreciate Anthony calling in. I tell you, it was a great one. I was up on stage afterwards after he won it, talking to him while he was signing autographs, and these kids were lined up. He said, you know, I could stand here for the next 2 days and sign autographs. But he signed my media card for me, got a picture front with him, with Taylor was there. Hope you watch it tomorrow. Show some interest. Get involved, because these things, when they happen, they are big events for our state. Here's the music. I'll see you on the other side. We got Justin Thayer on Tree Stand Safety. I didn't tell you, and I mentioned getting into the game and all, but Anthony was tailgating down at the Clemson game, so their kickoff was 3:30. I was trying to get through all this to get him into the game because he was really good, has been really good to me since the tour and the cup, and then making this Saturday, the day before it aired on TV, clear that he could be here. So we go from Clemson, South Carolina, all the way up to North Dakota, and are you in a duck blind right now, Justin, or are you in town taking a nap?
We're in town fixing to take a nap, Roger. So, yeah, we had a great morning. I was just listening to the break, the radio break. Sounds like y'all's low is about 42 tonight.
That's it.
Our low up here is about 29 degrees tonight, which is quite a change from when I left Mississippi yesterday at 90 degrees.
Yeah, I'm sure. I am sure. Well, look, thanks for calling in. And you were good enough to call in, so let me tell people a little bit about you right quick. You're from South Louisiana, an LSU grad with a BS and a master's degree in wildlife studies, 5 years as a deer biologist with the Mississippi Department of Wildlife, a wildlife biologist with Soterra LLC. You cover Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana. You manage about 240,000 acres of lease, outdoor consultants to private landowners across the South. You've been teaching tree stand safety for 4 years, working with the Tree Stand Manufacturers Association. I met you because I went to the Quality Deer Management Convention in Athens. You did a field module on tree stand safety, and you scared me to death. After that seminar, I wondered to myself, and we talked about the old Baker stands, because when I first started deer hunting, the old Baker stand was what you had, was essentially just the foot part to a modern stand, and you grabbed the tree and bear hugged it and pulled your feet up, that sort of thing. And I wondered how in the world we didn't have so many people dying, and you pretty much came up with a simple answer. There weren't many people climbing trees back then either.
That's exactly right. So it's interesting when I get to talking with clubs or different meetings about some of the old tree stand tactics like you're talking about with the Baker stand, and it is amazing we didn't have more falls back then.
Wow.
But, you know, we spend so much time as outdoorsmen and hunters preparing for the hunt, whether it's planting food plots or creating habitat or doing camera surveys. But we really spend very, very little time on the most important, the most basic thing, and that is just making it home and making sure that we set ourselves up to be able to come back home after each hunt. So.
Yeah. Essentially, for a deer hunter who climbs a tree stand, a successful hunt is like my dad when he used to fly. He said a successful day is a takeoff for every landing. So for a deer hunter, you know, getting up in the tree stand and coming back down is a successful hunt.
That is exactly right. And at the field module over at the QDMA convention, you know, nobody really wanted to come over and listen to a safety spiel, right? So what did we name the topic for the day? We did tree stand
tactics,
advanced tree stand tactics and safety. But, you know, I had to draw you in. I know I tricked you to draw you in to talk about safety, right? But y'all did, and unfortunately I did scare you, and that's probably because there's some things that you learned in the class, some simple things that you can cover as a hunter and as an outdoorsman, as a husband, as a wife, as a brother, to do some small things to make sure that you actually make it home. Because at the end of the day, tree stand accidents are the most common injury that we have in the hunting sport. It's leading the charge right now. If you're going to get injured while you're out there, more than likely you're going to fall out of a tree. And I imagine a lot of your listeners have experienced some type of fall, whether it was just a slide down a tree or an actual fall and hit the ground, or at worst, a fatality.
Yeah, so, poplar trees are the worst. And I was up a poplar tree one day. It was wet and I slid probably 20 feet down. It was a good thing I was up 25 feet because, you know, I was fixing to hit the ground full speed ahead before I stopped. And that was really scary. But, you know, I was 20 something years old and it was like I was in a homemade tree stand. It was a climber that somebody had made and I'd bought. It wasn't, you know, old man or, you know, anybody that name brand. It was just a friend of mine who had built one and I bought it from him, and it was scary. And I also had a friend who actually the two part stand, the top part broke and he had his feet in the stirrups. And so he hung upside down for an hour.
Right.
Until somebody came to him. And
it's a scary thing.
And when we were doing that, you were talking about the lifelines and all that. So, and you scared me to death. I'm going to have to invest a little money to get up to date in some of this stuff. But okay, you taught the module. You got a tree stand safety top 10. Let's do it.
It's pretty simple. I came up with my top 10. I work with the Tree Stand Manufacturers Association to help spread this message, and I don't get paid by those guys. And I literally took this class as a deer biologist working over in the state of Mississippi.
Okay.
And I was great. I was a great person in this class because I didn't think there was much I could learn from it. I've been hunting at elevated tree stands for a long time and hadn't experienced a fall, so I've done everything wrong. By the book, I've done everything wrong, but I had never actually hit the ground. I did have one slide experience, but I learned so much out of the class and realized it was so important that I jumped into it, got certified to teach it, and I've been teaching it since, and I do love teaching it. But out of everything, we can actually take the tree stand safety module, and I can teach an 8-hour course on just tree stand
safety. Wow.
It's amazing how much material you can actually cover. But we can sum it down in a kind of my top 10 things that you need to know real quick about tree stand safety. And most of these bullet points are short, and you can bring them back to your hunting club, or you can bring them to your husband or your wife or whoever it is and say, hey, do you do this? Because if you don't, man, I just heard that puts you at a serious risk for severe injury or death. And I want to repeat that term, severe injury or death, because you will find that term if you look at any of the instruction manuals for any of the tree stand equipment, whether it's your tree stand itself or your harnesses or the lifelines. You will see that line repeated multiple times. And if you remember in the module, I had just purchased a new stand, a new fixed position stand, and I had the instruction booklet with me for a major name brand company. And I asked y'all to guess how many times in that pamphlet it said severe injury or death.
Nobody had a clue.
Nobody had a clue. Do you remember how many times was in that 12-page document?
I don't, because honestly, I don't think I've ever read one of those myself.
There's step one, right?
Step 67
times in that stand's instructions, it referenced severe injury or death. We're not talking about something that you need to take lightly. This is the equipment that you have while you're hanging in that tree stands between you and severe injury or death. So the top 10 is simple. The first one is you've got to just, number one, you have to wear it.
Right.
We have a lot of falls. In Mississippi, we average about 16 reported falls. There's many more falls that go unreported, but you have to wear it. A lot of falls happen while guys are climbing stands and they're not connected to the tree. Most popular there is going to be a fixed position if a guy is not using a lifeline, which we'll talk about a little bit later.
Right.
But also for those guys in climbing stands that are rushing up the tree, take your time, put the harness on, and make sure you're connected to the tree at all times, because otherwise it doesn't do you any good.
That's right.
The second is simple, and this is one as a man I know that I do a lot more of now, but
okay.
You just need to read the instructions, the warnings, and the expiration date. A lot of people are saying, what do you mean expiration date?
Right. I was just going to ask you, what's an expiration date on a tree stand?
Right, exactly. So about 5 years on most of your tree stand equipment is going to be the rated expiration date. The time that you purchased it, 5 years. And you think about that equipment and how you treat it. You know, I used to leave deer stands out year-round. I no longer do that. I bring those things in, because there's going to be weak links in all of that equipment. At the end of the day, it's just man-made equipment, the straps especially. Read the instructions and the warnings, the expiration date. They will tell you everything you should know. And there's also DVDs that are in each of the TMA-certified stands.
I've seen those, too. That. Never watched one, but I've got them.
Yep. Yeah, everybody's got them. You got tons of them, you know, because they come with every TMA-certified stand. There's something to be said about a stand that's been certified through the Tree Stand Manufacturers Association.
Okay.
Because that gives you some level of confidence that stand has been tested to some certifications that meet or exceed their standards, and you know that it's been tested. So, you know, heed that certification, too. Be really wary of making your own stands or even buying somebody else's homemade stands. But read the warnings, watch that 20-minute DVD that comes with your tree stand harness or your tree stand, each of your TMA MA certified tree stand will actually come with it, its own full body harness. And that reminds me too, full body harness.
Yes.
We no longer wear the safety belt or just the chest harnesses. Those are out. You've got to have the full body harness. So that kind of moves us to step three. Is this is one that very, very few people actually do. And this is extremely important, and the instructions will tell you to practice suspending in that harness at ground level. And so that's actually suiting up in the harness and suspending right at ground level with a responsible adult standing there watching you to make sure everything goes good. But this is what I did in the class with y'all. Is
that's right.
Set a stand up
yep.
and suspend it out of it. Even though you're standing there amongst friends or an instructor or whatever it is, it puts you in a very awkward situation that you've never been in before. And you will understand what it feels like to have that pressure on your legs and on your chest and to be stuck in that situation. And it kind of lets the gravity of the situation or how bad it actually could be really sink in. But it also prepares you to what it's going to feel like in the event that you actually fall. Because right now the statistics say that 1 in 3 of us will experience a fall. Most of us won't actually have to suspend. You'll be able to recover back into the stand.
Right.
And if you're hooked up correctly, which we'll talk about next,
mm-hmm.
you should be able to actually get yourself back into the stand. But if you suspend, you'll learn something. You'll learn about the gravity of the situation.
And,
so I definitely recommend that.
And quickly, too. Because as soon as that,
yes.
as soon as you're suspending your body weight, especially around the straps around your legs, you feel it.
That's right. So on step four, we talk about making sure that you check your equipment before every use. The great example I gave about that was with my lifeline.
Mm-hmm.
I use lifelines in all my fixed position stands. But as I walk through my deer stand, I'll generally use no light to get all the way to the stand because I'm being stealthy. And then I've done all that work, and then I get to the stand, and you'll see me take my flashlight out, and I'll shine my light all the way up my stand, and I'm looking specifically at the straps of that stand and my lifeline to see if rodents, squirrels, raccoons, if something is tampered with it, which I've had happen. I've had something eat part of my lifeline.
Oof.
But I was able to check your equipment and take care of that equipment.
Right.
Keep it inside during the off season. Again, that equipment stands between you and severe injury and death.
Yep.
So next, we talk about proper tree strap placement. This is probably one of the most common things you'll see done wrong on most of your hunting shows, and I challenge your audience and you to look at the Outdoor Channel or Sportsman's Channel, and next time you see a guy hanging out of a tree stand, hopefully he's got a harness on, which most of the shows
most of them
have
do.
Harnesses now.
Yep.
Check out where they're connected to the tree. And this is very important. If you're sitting in your tree stand and you're sitting in your seated position, that knot, that tree strap should be placed above your head with no slack in the line.
Yeah, essentially what you told us in the class was you need to feel, if you even lean forward just a little bit, you need to feel that strap tightening up on you.
That's right. And who is the worst of all the types of hunters? Who's the worst ones about this?
Bow hunters.
Bow hunters, because they don't want to have that strap get in the way. But if you're hooked up correctly, the strap doesn't get in your way, and I demonstrated that, and
yep.
I challenge you to do this in your stand. But the reason that is so important to have that strap connected above your head is in the event of a fall, you actually don't fall anywhere.
That's right.
You fall a matter of inches versus if you take that strap like you see on the Outdoor Channel, you've got it behind your neck, or worse, you've got it at your waist, you've got 3 to 4 feet worth of fall. And it's not the shock load, not the stress of actually hitting the end of that line that's going to be the problem. It's where you end up after you fall in relation to where the stand is.
That's right, because
so,
you fall 2 or 3 feet below your stand, you may
right.
you can be in good shape and not be able to get back in that stand.
That's right. Most grown men aren't physically in good enough shape to do a pull-up to pull yourself back into the bottom of that
yep.
stand.
That's right.
Why it's so important. And as an archer, I use it fairly tight, and I'll actually use it as an extra anchor. It
uh-huh.
anchors me to that tree. I can step to the edge of that stand with confidence, and I know I'm connected, and it helps anchor me in. So.
and when in the module you were talking about placement and that sort of thing, and you said, and the worst thing I've ever seen is people take that strap and they leave it in the tree.
Oh, they'll leave the whole harness
in the tree.
Yes. So they just have to climb up the tree and put the harness on you. It sounds intuitive. That way you don't forget it, right?
No.
But you know, that system, that safety system is going to weather over time.
Yeah.
And you leave it out there in all those elements. And you wouldn't do that with your rifle, right?
No.
So don't do that with your safety equipment because it's standing there between you and severe injury.
Yep.
Like that.
Yep.
So
I thought that was...
The next step we talk about is the suspension release device.
And most of us don't have a clue what that is, Justin.
No, you don't have an...
No.
The ones that do have a clue are the hunter safety system guys.
That's right.
Because they remember seeing it in the package. There's a long... It looks like an extra long key lanyard.
That's it.
And in the package, it comes separate with hunter safety systems. Depending on the harness that you buy, it may be included, built in, like the summit. They'll have it actually built in the side of the waistband.
Right.
It'll be a long rope. Or in the case of hunter safety systems and some of the other brands, it'll be separate. And hunter safety systems has got written on there that it says suspension or release device. And then the other thing it says, do you remember? It says...
Uh-oh.
Deer drag.
That's right.
Right? So everybody that's got a hunter safety system has got a deer drag.
That's right.
They throw it in their pack, right?
That's right.
Well, a suspension relief device is a tool that you have to address suspension trauma.
Yep.
And that happens if you're suspended in a tree for any period of time. Again, you've got those leg straps that are there to help support your fall.
But once
you've fallen,
yep,
they're cutting circulation off your leg. And that blood flow, the reduced blood flow to your heart and your brain, in somewhere between, generally between 3 and 20 minutes, you are going to start to experience some level of suspension trauma.
Yeah.
So what generally happens when you end up losing blood flow to your brain?
Blackout.
You black out. So you're no good to yourself the people that are trying to rescue you if you're at the point where you're suspended. This is worst case.
You've
done everything right and you fall, but you're hooked up, your tree strap was hooked up correctly. Hopefully you'll be able to fall, you'll be able to climb right back into your stand.
Right.
But in worst case scenario, let's say you have a complete stand failure.
Drops to the bottom of the tree.
Well, you're stuck. You've fallen, but you're suspended. You've got to address that suspension trauma. And that device, that simple rope, is nothing more than an extra long lanyard that'll hang down by your feet. And it allows you to step into a loop, which then you step up, and that frees the blood flow in that particular leg or legs, depending on the system, and brings that blood back to your heart and your brain. So you actually can do exercises. And again, that's all explained in the instructions. It's explained in the DVD. But there's very few people that know what it is, much less carry it on their person.
Yeah.
And the guys with the deer drag carry it in a bag, right?
That's right. Yep.
So your bag, if you're in that situation, your bag's going to be on the ground.
That's right. And you actually had them practicing that as they were suspended off the side of the tree stand. You had them use that suspension device to take the pressure off, to push
that's
up
right.
on it. And it wasn't easy to do. I mean, we had
the guy
that was doing it in our module was kind of young, and he was having a tough time doing it.
That's right. It's not comfortable, and that's where practicing this at ground level will give you the confidence in the event that this ever happens, God forbid, but you'll know how to react to it and get through the situation. Because, you're at that point where you're stuck and you're suspended. That leads us to the next part of the 10 step is, was your hunt plan known by others? And if it's not, you're going to be in a real bind. Right?
That's right.
So, got to make your location known to others, and then the next one, step 8, is going to be making sure you've got an emergency signal device on your person. Again, that suspension release device or your phone, if it's in your pack and it's at the bottom of the tree and you're stuck, you're in a bind, especially if nobody knows how to get to you. I use a pretty cool, we've all got smartphones now.
Right.
It's become extremely easy for us to communicate our location to other people. So I use an app when I pick a tree. If it's a tree that if my dad or somebody from the club doesn't know where I'm going to be at, really simple. I pull my phone up, and in a matter of less than a minute, I can send my location directly. I generally send it to my dad. If he can actually come get me, he knows where I'm going to be at and how to get there, and then I'll copy my wife on it just to kind of make her feel better.
What's that app, Justin?
I've got an Android phone. I use one called GPS Share. It's really simple, but you can use, there's a variety of different ones. You can also use just a standard Google Maps and hold down on the map and it'll show your location. You can send it via text.
There it is. GPS Share. Free.
Very simple. Yeah, it's free.
Yep.
And again, in the matter of suspension relief time, you're going to end up experiencing some issues within 3 to 20 minutes.
Right.
Depending on how your physical health and how you're suspended. And how long is it going to take somebody to actually come find you?
That's right.
I know in my camp, most of the places that I hunt, I'm going to be looking at a solid, if somebody's at the camp, it's going to be 30 minutes before they come find me and get to me. And then when they get to you, do you have a plan set up on how they would recover you?
To get down again.
That's
right.
You're going to be there. If you're in this situation, you're going to be there for a minute. And the last two steps that we talk about are simply kind of prevention type things.
Okay.
We talk about using Lifeline, and we mentioned that several times before. You want to explain what a Lifeline does?
Well, a Lifeline attaches to a point above your fixed stand or ladder stand, your seat or whatever. It attaches to the ground around the base of the tree, and it has, and I forget the name of that knot. What is it?
Proustic knot.
There you go. And what you do is you attach to that as you climb the tree, and that knot will slide up, but under pressure, it will not slide down.
That's correct.
Hey, I learned something.
So, there you go. That's what I was testing you. You passed. So a Lifeline is simply put, it's a 30-foot shock-loaded rope.
Yep.
It's just nothing more than that with a simple Proustic knot, a single, or you can buy them in tandem, or if you've got a double set for a father-son team or a video guy, that you can have two Proustic knots that it runs from the bottom of the tree to the top. Once you install your fixed position, at the same time, you can install your Lifeline.
Right.
And that fixes the old problem of, well, I've got a safety harness on, but I can't connect in my lock-on stand until I get to the top. Well, now you've got a way to connect to the tree the whole time. You just drag that knot with you.
Yep.
And I demonstrated that in class. The only way that you can go wrong with the Lifeline is by holding on to the knot the entire time.
Right.
And that knot works by pressure. And as you slide it up, you should grab that Proustic knot, slide it to eye level or above, and then make another step.
Yep.
And you're climbing the tree very slow, calm, safe. And you just grab your knot, slide it a little bit, and then take another step.
We got about a minute left for the last one, so give it to me.
I was going to say, if you hang on to that knot,
yep.
If you end up falling, you're going to clinch two things on the way down, right? You're going to clinch that knot will be the first thing. And so that knot, if you're clinching it, you'll actually slide down the tree.
That's right.
So use a Lifeline. And then also check out the lineman's belt for installing. Anybody who hunts with a fixed position stand, make sure you use that. Pick up a lineman's belt. It connects around the tree. It gives you the ability use both hands when you're installing those stands, but you're always going to still use your primary Lifeline or your primary tree strap to connect to the tree. You actually connect it twice. It just gives the guy installing a fixed position stand the ability to work more safely with both hands instead of one.
Yep. Well, look, Justin, a ton of information. I really enjoyed your field module, and that's why I said, you know, I've got to do tree stand safety with hunting season here, and I had to get you. I appreciate you taking your time from your duck hunting holiday up there in North Dakota. You sent me some pictures this morning. Be sure to send me some more this afternoon. And as you get back, I'd love to keep in touch with you.
All right, man. I appreciate it. Y'all stay safe.
Take care, Justin. Thanks.
Okay, take care.
It's an important issue. I hope, if you hunters are out there in the woods, you didn't hear that. I hope your wives staying at home heard all that. A successful hunt is coming home. Whether you saw anything is irrelevant as far as I'm concerned. I just want to make it back home at night. And it's a lot of information. A lot of it we tend to forget over the years. You get, just like anything else, you get comfortable with what you do. And you don't take as precautions as you should. So Oh, wow. We're almost to the end here, so let's get Chuck Norris for today. Chuck Norris can set ants on fire with a magnifying glass. You got it. At night. Next week's going to be a tape show. I'm going to be working on how to make this show better next year at a conference. But we've got Ben Lancaster from Outdoor Underwriters in Columbia. They're an insurance company for the outdoorsman. We're also going to be talking to Dr. John Kilgo. He's a research wildlife biologist with the USDA Forest Service Savannah River site. He just wrapped up a 6-year study on coyotes and fawn predation. So there again, next week's going to be another show packed with information. I hope you'll be here. I'm having fun recording it, that's for sure. I want to thank Anthony Gagliardi for being here. Don't forget to watch that show tomorrow at 3. Justin for calling in from North Dakota. There's James. It's fall outside. Go do something. Be careful. Travel the back roads. Don't forget the camera. I'll see you next week. Thanks.